space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations,
to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
six, five, four, three, two, one, zero. Blast off!
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Electricity and efficiency. So, in order to understand what the heck is going on out there, you got to think about electricity in a different way. That's kind of hard to do with today's modern high-tech terminology that they try to lay on you. So, with that said, I'm going to try to play a few things, because if you get a basic understanding of what science says electricity is, then it might make a little bit more sense what old Shaziz has been yapping at for so long. And so, with that said, I got a couple little podcasts that I want to play so that you can just get a general understanding of what basic science says about electricity. So let's start off with this first one. I think this one here is, I can't even remember, rimstar.org, I think.
Hi, gang. I get asked every now and then, what is ground? Sometimes it's to do with household ground, this prong and hole in your plug. Sometimes it's about finding a good ground when making something. And sometimes it's ground in an electronic circuit. So I thought I'd talk about each of these. Let's start with household ground. In North America, this roundish hole is ground. And so the prong and a plug that goes in it is the ground prong. But to understand that ground hole and prong, we first have to understand the other two holes. In North America, they're called hot and neutral, and the wires are usually black and white. They're what carry the electricity that powers things. Behind the hole called hot, you'll find a wire that runs behind the walls, and eventually goes to a breaker in your breaker panel. From there, the electricity goes behind the breakers to one of these thick black wires, and then outside your house to a transmission pole and transformer somewhere. The other hole, again called neutral here in North America, also goes to that breaker panel, but not to any breaker. Instead, it goes to this metal bar. From there, the electricity goes along this thick white wire, and then outside your house to the same transmission pole and the same transformer. Here that all is in a diagram. This is the path for the hot, or black wire, to the breaker and out to the transformer. And this is the path for the neutral, or white wire, through the breaker panel and out to the transformer. The other side of the transformer is what continues on to the generating station. So where does the ground hole go? It also has a wire that goes to the breaker panel and connects to this other metal bar, which is connected to the breaker panel's metal case. And it's not clear with this panel, but somewhere the case is connected to the neutral bar. A diagram now looks like this, with the ground wire going to a ground bar and then onto the neutral bar. But why is the ground wire connected to the neutral bar like that? That's in case you have a break in the insulation covering a wire somewhere. That break can cause a fault, such as in this microwave oven. Three wires enter the microwave oven. Those three wires are connected to the three prongs of the plug, hot, neutral, and ground. As we said, the electricity flows through the hot and neutral wires. The third wire is the ground wire. The ground wire is connected to the metal case, and normally no electricity flows through it. We'll add the microwave oven to our diagram. The hot and neutral wires go to the electronics, and the ground wire connects to the case. But the case is not connected to anything else. Electricity won't flow on it because there's no return path. But what if the insulation around the hot wire gets damaged, and the wire itself touches the metal case? The case is now connected to the hot wire. If you were to touch the case, you'd get a dangerous shock. But luckily, the ground wire is connected to the case. That ground wire is a very low resistance path for the electricity, and so it will flow from the hot, through the case, through the ground wire, and back to the panel where the ground is connected to the neutral, and back to the transformer, completing the circuit with the hot wire there. However, since that path is such low resistance, the current will be very high. And remember that the hot path goes through a breaker in the breaker panel. The current will be high enough to trip that breaker, disconnecting the power, and making it safe to touch the microwave oven's case again. Let's look at it again, but on the diagram. The problem starts when insulation on the hot wire breaks, and the wire touches the microwave oven's case. Since the case is connected to the ground wire, we now have this complete circuit, along the ground wire to the breaker panel, then along the neutral wire, onward to the transformer on the pole, through the transformer's coil, back through the hot, through the breaker, and continuing to the hot in the microwave oven, where it's touching the case. There's very little resistance along that circuit, and so the electrical current will be very high, high enough to trip the breaker, which opens the circuit, making it safe to touch the microwave oven's case again. But wait, none of that had anything to do with the earth ground. Why is the wire called ground? Looking at the breaker panel again, there's thick ground wire connected to the neutral bar here that goes to a metal rod buried in the ground, called a ground rod, or to some other metal that's buried in the earth ground somewhere, like the metal pipe that brings cold water in from the city. And where the neutral wire goes to the transformer, there's another wire that goes down the pole to a ground rod there too. Now our diagram looks like this, with the thick bare wire from the breaker panel to earth ground, and with the ground wire from where the neutral wire connects to the transformer, also down to earth ground. Why have all this wiring all the way to the earth ground, if it didn't play a part in our microwave oven fault? To understand that, we need to learn a bit about electric charge. Electric charge can be either positive or negative. Looking at an atom, the protons locked in the atom's nucleus have a positive charge, and the electrons surrounding the nucleus have a negative charge. Overall, this atom has a neutral charge, though, neither positive nor negative, because it has the same number of positive protons and negative electrons. Like charges repel each other. Here we have an area with extra electrons between the atoms, so the area is negatively charged overall. If we try to bring in yet another negative electron, it feels a repulsion, so it's harder to make it go there. The like charges repel each other. But what if that area was the size of the Earth? Or maybe just your neighborhood? To negatively charge such a large area would take a lot of extra electrons. Similarly, we could positively charge the area by taking electrons from it, leaving more positive protons than negative electrons. But it doesn't matter. The ground is such a large volume that the ground normally doesn't get very charged either way. It remains with a fairly neutral charge. So what's a good ground? A good ground is one that has a large enough volume that it can handle whatever charge you're trying to give it without it ever becoming very charged. Now back to why we're connecting wires all the way to Earth ground. One reason has to do with lightning. Remember that the breaker panel case is connected to ground, and so is this microwave oven's case. When lightning strikes nearby, those cases can become charged. By connecting to Earth ground, that charge bleeds away to the ground, keeping the cases safe to touch. Let's say the case becomes negatively charged. As we said, like charges repel each other. Since the ground has a fairly neutral charge, the electrons on the case repel along the wire to the Earth ground, and they keep repelling until there's an even amount of charge everywhere. Since the ground can take a lot of charge, the overall charge doesn't even out until everything's fairly neutral. And yet another way to look at it is that the negatively charged case has a certain quantity of charge, and the neutrally charged ground has a different quantity of charge. That means they have different electric potentials. A potential difference, or a voltage, exists between them. Since there's voltage between them, if you connect them with a wire, current will flow. Electrons will flow from the negatively charged case to the neutral ground. For a ground rod to work well, the ground does have to be electrically conductive, though, meaning it has a low resistance. Dry sand like this is not very conductive, and is a bad ground. But moist soil is fairly conductive, and is a better ground. Also, the more ground you connect to, the better. Here I just pushed some wires into the ground, and it wasn't very good. I even poured water in to help, but it still wasn't great. You can buy copper and galvanized steel rods that are around 6 to 10 feet long that you can pound into the ground. But keep in mind that cold ground lowers the conductivity, so make sure to drive it below the frost line for winter use. Besides the ground hole in the power socket, where can you find a ground to use? If the current and voltage aren't too high that you get hurt, then your own body can sometimes act as an okay ground. An example where I've done that is with this portable pizza box crystal radio. It's portable because it doesn't need a ground to work, but it works better with one. And if you look closely here, you'll see my hand is on this capacitor plate. The capacitor is one aluminum foil cylinder that slides around another one, and with paper in between. Making a lot of skin contact with the outer cylinder lets it conduct charge to my hand and body. Here, I'm the ground. Often when playing with high voltage, you'll have a ball that's connected to a wire going to ground, and make a spark by bringing that near a charged object, like this Van de Graaff generator. A fairly safe way to ground that, if you don't have a ground rod that you can connect to directly, is to find a metal pipe that you're certain goes into the ground, like this copper cold water intake pipe from the city. Or this metal fence would do, since it makes plenty of contact with the ground. And finally, what about this ground symbol in the schematic for an electrical circuit? Well, it's called ground, but very often it's more of a common reference. For example, this schematic is for this amplifier. Notice that it doesn't contact any ground. In that case, it just means that all these points are connected together. For the circuit board, I soldered all those points to a bare wire in the back. Anything connected to that common reference will have voltages that are relative to that common, a sort of zero for that voltage. There are other ground symbols too. This one means chassis ground, such as the chassis of a car, basically a continuous piece of metal that many things in the car are connected to, including battery negative. Sometimes, though, the ground symbol does actually refer to connecting to Earth ground. This is the schematic for this power supply, one that you plug into a wall, with a plug that has a ground prong. In this case, the symbol is saying to connect to that ground prong, though I guess the only hint is that these points are labeled as hot and neutral, the names for the other two prongs in the plug. Well, thanks for watching. See my YouTube channel for more informative videos like this. You can support these videos either through Patreon or through a one-time donation. And if you like these videos, don't forget to subscribe, give a thumbs up, share with your social media, or leave a question or comment below. See you soon.
Okay, so that's the first one. Okay, if you Google up electricity and efficiency, it'll say on the very top of there, heat rate is one measure of efficiency of a generator or power plant that converts a fuel into heat and into electricity. The heat rate is the amount of energy used by an electrical generator or power plant to generate 1 kilowatt hour of electricity. Heat's a really important thing to keep an eye on right there. So while you're listening to these little short podcasts here, see if you can figure out why it is I'm trying to share these with you.
It never would have happened without Cooper Trucks.
Cooper Trucks? Yay!
One of the questions I get quite often when I'm teaching, because I teach electricity, is what exactly is voltage? Well, it's been taught forever that it's electrical pressure, and since all of you guys pretty much understand how pressure works, this should make pretty good sense. This is an electron. An electron is the negatively charged particle that spins around the outside of an atom, and it's what actually moves through a wire, and it's what actually makes electricity work. Electron electricity. Well, I like to think of these electrons as negative because they have a little negative attitude and a little negative charge. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't for you. But it also helps to think about magnets, because everybody watching this understands what a magnet is and how it works. Okay, you take two magnets and you put the two north poles together, then they repel each other. Okay, everybody gets that. And the way it's taught in class is that like poles repel. However, we all know that if you take magnets and you put them together with the north and south pole together, or the south or north pole together, then they attract. There's a force that's actually pulling them together. And that force is the magnetic force. And we also teach that unlike poles attract. So like poles repel and unlike poles attract. So let's take our electrons, which both have negative charges, and we'll put them together, and they're fairly negative, as you can tell. I draw them that way because electrons are negative, and those look like some guys that got some pretty negative attitudes. Well, they have the same charge. And if you apply the magnet example, then what you get is you get a force that's trying to push these two guys apart. The force is pretty powerful. It's a pretty strong force. And it's what makes our components run, makes them work. So if you think about this, it works really well to just visualize a spring between the two electrons. Pretend they're billiard balls on a pool table. Well, you probably already have this figured out by now, because if you take two pool balls and put them on a table with a spring in between them and you let go, they're going to move, because there's pressure in between them. All right, well, now they're a little more angry and a little more negative because they're being forced to be much closer to each other. And when you push these guys closer together, the force between them is pretty huge. And this is why it's called tension. Electrical tension. High tension electricity. They're tense. They're stuck there next to each other, wanting nothing more than to get as far away from each other as possible. That's what makes them move. The spring is much more tightly compressed now. And if you carry this analogy to the end, the higher compression means higher voltage. So, how does this work for us? Why is this theory important to us? It's important because voltage is what we measure, and knowing how voltage works helps when you measure it, so you'll know what it's doing or not doing. Well, if you put a bunch of these electron guys together, put them in a box, they call it a battery. So, all these little electron guys in here all have negative charges, and they're all trying really hard to get pretty far away from each other. And that then puts them under pressure. This pressure is what makes everything happen. You can't have flow without a difference in pressure. Hydraulics or pneumatics, it doesn't matter. So, if we take the battery, and we connect the battery into a circuit, and by the way, it's called a circuit because it's a circle, you give them a place to go, they're going to go. They don't actually move at the speed of light, but the effect is felt at the speed of light. So, with the switch open here, you're going to have charges to the left and charges to the right. The polarity is difficult to explain, but effectively, electricity is waiting at the switch. Sitting there stable, not moving. That's called static voltage. But as soon as you close the switch, now things start to happen. They start moving, and moving, and moving, and moving, and moving, and moving really, really fast. We put a motor in the way, and all of this movement works to create motion. So the motor goes zoom. And if a bunch of these guys in a box sitting there waiting to go is voltage, then it's pretty easy to understand what current is. It's them moving and getting away from each other. And we use that to do work. Alright, every load has resistance. Light bulbs, coils, resistors, and the resistance is measured in ohms. And the guy that figured this out, his name was George Simon Ohm, hence the word. Now, for those of you who are like up on this stuff, yeah, motors do have back EMF, but we're going to cover that another day. We're just going to treat it as if it has ohms, because effectively it does have ohms. Alright, well, we get our motor there, and you ask yourself, what is the job of any resistor, or of any resistance, what's its job? And the simplest way to understand it is that the job of the resistance is to keep the fuse from blowing. By the way, if it's a motor, then it turns. But the reason that the fuses don't blow when you turn things on is because the thing you're turning on has resistance. So, how do we summarize this? Well, voltage, which is pressure, pushes amperage, which is current, through a resistance. This is actually Ohm's law, because Ohm's law is a concept. Ohm's law is a principle. Ohm's law is not a math equation. They use E equals IR, and they teach it as math, but it is not a math problem. Ohm's law is a concept, not math. So, voltage, which is pressure, resistance, and current, work together to make our machines go.
Alrighty, so with that said, give me a second here. Hold on. Let me stop that there. Alright, so with that said, what he was talking about, and an electrical heater is an electrical device that converts an electric current into heat. The heating element inside every electric heater is an electrical resistor. The resistance is what's really important to understand. See, if you're going to understand how to become efficient, if you're going to understand how to work on your alternative energy devices, you got to get a general idea of what's actually going on in there mechanically, why things are actually getting hot. So an electrical heater is an electrical device that converts an electrical current into heat. The heat and heating element inside every electric heater is an electrical resistor and works on the principle of the Joule heating and electrical current passing through a resistor will convert the electrical energy into heat energy. A lot of people out there are arguing over what electricity is, whether there is or isn't an electron or whatever, but when you look at something mechanically and you just pay attention to the cause and the effect of it, really it doesn't matter what electricity really is. I mean, that'd be nice to actually get down to the actual brass tacks of everything, so to speak. But when you're trying to engineer something mechanically, why something gets hot, why it is that your generator or your inverters or anything, any appliance that you're using basically gets hot and at some point will reach a thermal breakdown and fail, you first got to understand what's going on here. Voltage being pressure, and you know, when you're pushing too much pressure, too much current through anything, now any device becomes a resistor. And the more resistance that it has to that current flow, the more heat will be generated into that system. So now you got to figure out a way by which you can actually get that energy to flow freely, but still give you same amount of power that you needed to run your devices. And so we'll get into that a little bit later. I just want to first play these basic concepts of electricity so the average Joe can kind of get a general understanding. You don't have to be an electronic
engineer. So when you get your home energy bill, it lists the usage in kilowatt hours. But when you go to the store, you'll see things like 12-watt light bulbs, 9-volt batteries, and vacuum cleaners with 15 amps of sucking power. But what do these numbers even mean? I mean, why do we have so many different units to measure something that seems as straightforward as electricity? Surprisingly, the answer isn't just so appliance companies and physics professors can confuse you. It's because several important things have to happen in an electrical circuit for electricity to flow and for work to be done. You can think of a circuit kind of like the faucet on your kitchen sink. If you want water to come out, you need two things. You need the water itself, and some pressure to force it through the pipes, out your faucet, and into your neti pot. Similarly, an electrical circuit uses electrons to carry the electricity, kind of like the water in our faucet analogy. But those electrons need something to push them along a circuit. This electrical pressure is what we call voltage, and is often provided by two terminals, one with a positive charge and one with a negative charge. So on a battery, electrons flow from the negative end through whatever it is you're trying to power, and then into the positive end, where they'll stay unless your battery is rechargeable. If you're plugging something into the wall, this voltage is instead provided by your power company. And although voltage just measures how strongly electricity is being pushed through a circuit, it's important because many circuits are designed only to accept a certain number of volts, which is why the hairdryer you bought in Monaco might release magic blue smoke if you plug it in New York. So now that you know what volts are, what about amps? Well, in this context, amp isn't short for amplifier, but rather for ampere, which is a unit of how much electrical charge is flowing past a given point in 1 second. So when you put volts and amps together, you can tell how much current is flowing and how hard it's flowing. Multiply these numbers and you get, finally, our third unit, the watt. Let's go back to our water analogy for a second. Let's suppose you wanted to spin a small water wheel because you just like watching things spin, or I don't know, maybe you have it hooked up to a generator. Let's say you have a really powerful water pistol that forces water through a tiny nozzle. Even though the small nozzle means the total volume of water flowing per second isn't all that much. You wouldn't want to fill your swimming pool with it. The high pressure creates a strong jet that can spin the wheel easily. But suppose instead of a water gun, you have a much wider hose that doesn't push the water out nearly as strongly, but because the hose is a lot wider, more water flows per second overall, and the wheel ends up spinning at the same speed it did with your water gun. If we think of the hose and the water gun pushing out electricity instead of water, we could say that they're delivering the same number of watts. For a more practical example, let's say you have an 1100-watt power supply for your computer that's drawing full load because you're rocking four-way SOI or something. So if you plug that into a standard 110-volt North American outlet, some simple math tells you that 10 amps of current is running through your power supply. But if you take that same power supply and use it with a 220-volt European outlet, you're only drawing 5 amps. But since the amount of power in watts is the same, your computer will work just fine in both places, even though you're using different volts and amps. Well, that makes sense, Linus. But why the heck, then, is my energy bill in kilowatt hours? Is that a unit of time? No, actually, scientists are just mean. It's a unit of energy. Watts and kilowatts express how much energy is consumed per chunk of time, something scientists call power, which is not the same as energy. But if you multiply a kilowatt by an hour, the units cancel, and you're left with a number that shows how much energy that you hogged by running your air conditioner, gaming rig, and novelty lava lamp all at once. But what if you're more concerned about battery capacity instead of what's coming out of your walls? Well, if you're buying a replacement battery or a battery pack, you might see their capacity listed in milliamp hours, again, not time. Doing the math shows that this is a unit of charge, not energy or power. So going back to our water example, this is like how much water you have in a bucket, not how much is flowing or how fast is flowing. So a bigger bucket means you could charge your phone more times, and you can learn more about that and battery banks in this video here. So go forth then with your newfound knowledge and expertly buy the right voltage adapter. Install the correct power supply, or just ace your electrical engineering exam if you want to do more with your life than work for some second-rate YouTube channel. But what? Hey, John, second-rate YouTube channel? Like, is that supposed to be a joke? That's not funny.
Actually, it is quite funny. All right, so I got one more. By the way, because I forgot to say it, you're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html, as well as if you scroll down underneath the chat rooms, you'll find a link to People for People Radio Network. Go over and say hi to those nice folks and tell them old crazy haired Shaziz sent you. So anyway, also don't forget to check out Wolf Spirit Radio. So I got one more little short podcast, I think. Let me check and see. No, maybe two. All right, let's try this. Video unavailable. Watch this video on YouTube. What? Are you crazy? All right, let's click it on YouTube. Probably give us a commercial now.
Hi, I'm Emerald Robinson. In this What Is video, we're going to take a closer look at electricity. Electricity is a natural force that we harness for our energy needs. To understand electricity, we need to know a little more about atoms, the tiny particles that make up our universe. Three smaller particles make up atoms: neutrons, electrons, and protons. Electrons have a negative charge, protons have a positive charge, and neutrons are neutral. The center of the atom includes neutrons and protons, while the electrons orbit the center like the Earth orbits the Sun. Stable atoms have an equal number of protons and electrons and have no charge. If a material holds onto its electrons tightly, it is known as an insulator. If its electrons are more loosely bound, it's called a conductor. When a large number of free electrons pile up at one end of a conductor, particles that have the same charge repel each other, while particles that have opposite charges attract. These negative electrons push each other apart, jumping from atom to atom through the conductor, creating electricity. There are two forms of electricity, current and static. Current electricity travels. It is composed of flowing electrons passing from one atom to another through a conductive material. It is this form of electricity that powers our homes. Static electricity is a charge at rest on an object. Sometimes your body picks up extra electrons through friction and becomes negatively charged. When you touch a conductor, like a metal doorknob, you experience a small shock as the static charge jumps from your body to the doorknob. Electricity is a secondary energy source, meaning we have to convert energy from another source into electric power. Sources of electricity include burning natural gas and coal, nuclear power, and natural sources of power such as wind, water, and solar energy. And that's the shocking truth about electricity.
Yay, the shocking truth. All right, one last one.
Okay, there's a couple of guys on our forum that want to know how to make a monopole magnet. And that is a magnet that has only one pole. Now, it can be done, but there is a catch. What we have here is a ball bearing that likes to roll all over the place. Get it to sit still. Steel screwdriver. As you can see, it's just a ball bearing. It's not a magnet. Over here, of course, we have a magnet. Now, I've painted one end of the magnet just so you can see that I do in fact turn it around. You can see one way is one pole and the other way is the other pole. So to get this to become a monopole magnet, we have to put it within one of the two fields of a permanent magnet, which is what we've done here. Now I've used a speaker magnet and I've mounted six of them little ball bearings in a rotor, as you can see. And if we take our magnet here, which of course is north one end, south the other, you will see that one end wants to suck the steel ball towards it, which is normal, and you'll see the other end will actually push the steel ball away, like that. And it doesn't matter which side you put it on, the effect is the same. So that's how you create a monopole magnet. If this speaker magnet is north up, these will carry the fields of that north and the whole ball will become a monopole magnet in itself. But the catch is, of course, it does have to be within a field of a permanent magnet. As soon as these are removed from that field, they of course return back to just the ball bearing. But while they are in that field, they will of course be attracted to one pole and be repelled by another pole, just like that. Now you'll see guys that make the what they call a lensless generator by having a fixed magnet, fixed coil, and a rotating steel plate to break that field. The reason they will get the lens effect still is because of this very situation. The steel plate will become part of the permanent magnet that they are trying to break the fields from. By putting another speaker magnet on top of this device, it doubles the strength of the fields within these steel balls, and they will repel a like field much stronger than what they are doing here. So they, like I said, one side will repel and the other side will attract. So that's how you create a monopole magnet. They don't become a permanent magnet, but they do remain as a magnet carrying the fields while they're in the vicinity of the fields. So that's how you do it. I don't know if it's any good to you guys in what you're trying to achieve, but that's how it can be done. Okay, cheers from the Tin Man.
All right, that guy was Tin Man on YouTube. All these video links that I just played, if you're interested in checking them out, are posted in all the chat rooms over there at the Super Chat. But he was basically just explaining how to make a monopole magnet, which for those folks out there in alternative energy that are trying to figure out how to make monopole magnets, and the reason being why they would want to make a monopole magnet is to constantly get something to repel it. That is one method by which you're not actually connected to the magnet, but you're within that magnetic field. And so the key to that whole deal is to basically get to guide energy. Even magnetic fields can be guided where you want it to go. Let's see. All right, so anyway, I'm going to go ahead and see if I can add Raymond to the call, because he wanted to get up in here. See if I can get him on the phone there. See how much noise he's going to make. How you doing, Raymond? We're live.
Pretty good. How you doing?
Pretty good.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. So, anyway, like I was getting ready to say here, basically, in order to be able to understand how to achieve efficiency, first you got to understand a little bit of basic simple of what science actually said electricity actually is. The keys in everything that we've heard so far is voltage being pressure. And the way that we're running electricity, we're actually pushing too much electricity through our appliances. This is what causes them to get hot. That falls under that part where about resistance. When you have a material such as what I read earlier, let me go ahead and read this again. An electrical heater is an electrical device that converts an electric current into heat. The heating element inside every electric heater is an electrical resistor and works on the principle of Joule heating. An electric current passing through a resistor will convert that electrical energy into heat. Essentially,
isn't that actually friction?
Huh?
Like what? Isn't that actually friction?
Well, friction, resistance, it's all the same.
Yeah, right. Resistance is friction. Friction is resistance. And all friction creates heat.
All right, so
we're gonna get
to a method by which see, when you want to produce heat with electricity, it's simple. All you gotta do is run electrical current through resistors, and the resistor's going to get hot. Like different materials like nichrome wire, which are really resistant to electrical current. Tungsten wire elements as well are resistant to current flow, so they will also get hot. So it's that resistance, that friction, like Raymond just mentioned right here, basically trying to slow down that amount of energy. And so, if you're pushing too much current to anything, then you're going to turn what would have normally been just a normal circuit into the equivalence of a resistor. It's going to generate heat. But you don't need all that current in order to be able to run things. So we got to figure out a way by which we can actually get rid of some of that power and only take off what we need, and that's what we're going to try to get to today. So let me see here, what's next on my list? I just said we're going to give that power somewhere to go. We're going to create a storage buffer, and we're going to be able to maintain constant pressure. I had Googled up constant pressure in there somewhere. Let me see what. Since the pressure is constant, the force exerted is constant, and the work done is given as PAV. What? An isobaric expansion of gas requires heat transfer to keep the pressure constant. An isochoric process is one which the volume is held constant, meaning that the work done by the system will be zero. Well, that didn't help out a lot. That was a whole lot of high-tech terminology for nothing. So anyway, essentially, it's just like anything else. If you compress a gas, you're going to cause it to get heat because you got pressure. You got a lot of pressure. You're forcing all these protons, electrons, and neutrons in together. You're causing it to get hot. So we can use that bit of physics and knowledge in order to make air conditioning, heating, cooling, HVAC kind of stuff. And so when you get an understanding of what's happening there, you got a mechanical gear ticking in your head now. So with our
your words were correct, but it could lead someone, that was a weird thinker like me, to believe that you're creating heat. No, what you're doing is you're taking a whole lot of heat in a big area and compacting it into a smaller area. It's hotter, but it's not really more heat. It's the same amount of heat. You see what I'm saying? But it's more compacted. I understand what you're saying, but I don't know, it's weird. Like I said, I'm weird. Like, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt, but just want to clarify that.
Now, see, when you heat something up, you're going to develop pressure. Heat expands, cold contracts. So when you're compressing, when you're compressing that air, I'm not saying that you're getting more heat out than you put in or anything like that. That's not what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say, I'm trying to give you an idea of what actually is causing the heat. You know, it's all cause and effect, everything. Everything we're doing. So when you want to understand how to become more efficient, then you got to figure out what is it that's actually causing losses in your system. And the main cause of losses in any system is heat. So you generate heat, it causes things to either be less conductive or, you know, wasted energy that is actually going towards getting that heat production going on. And so there's where our circuits have problems. And then we end up having to add secondary systems to those circuits in order to take away that heat. Like sinks and fans.
What you're saying is possible. You're saying we need to figure out how to run the machines more efficiently. And the thing is, you keep talking about resistance and heat, and you said it's possible. And I know it's possible because the two-stage oscillator does exactly what you're talking about. The more resistance you put on it, the less energy it takes to run it. And the less the energy it takes to run it, the less it heats up. So, to the principle, not the two-stage oscillator, the principles of what you're trying to say does exist. It's there.
Well,
and the two-stage oscillator proves your idea that it is possible.
Basically,
the more resistance,
When I'm running a generator and I'm pushing out a lot of power out of that generator, in reality, your generators are capable of producing a whole lot more power than you're actually able to use because you're trying to move that energy through a system that is now becoming a resistor. It's not just the lens effect or the cogging effect, that the back EMF that's actually slowing you down. It's the fact that, like, as if you blow up a balloon really fast, you know, or you just keep a constant pressure on that balloon, eventually that balloon can't hold any more pressure. So it's either going to pop or it's going to resist the flow of inside pressure. And so the heavier pressure is always going to win out. That's why it's harder for you to blow up like one of them rubber water bottles than it is blow up a thin balloon. And if you try to blow up that rubber bottle, water bottle, you might get a lot of pressure in there. But once that that resistance of that water bottle overcomes the resistance that you're trying to push power in, then it's going to push back in the other direction. And so that's what has happened when you put a load on a generator, is that you build that pressure up and you can't overcome that pressure because of the resistance that you're getting on the opposite side. Well, that resistance is going to do one of two things. Actually, both things. It's going to start to push back and it's going to generate heat. And that heat is what you don't want in your circuitry. So we got to figure out a means by which to, if we're going to be running that much power out of a generator, we need to figure out a means by which to get that energy to go somewhere. We don't want to lose that energy, but we need to get it to go somewhere so that we can conserve that energy without forcing too much of it forward, if you understand what I'm saying. It's kind of like the difference between trying to blow a balloon up as opposed to one of those rubber water bottles. So if you're blowing a balloon up, obviously more pressure goes through there, the balloon's going to explode and that energy is going to move forward. It's going to go on down the line to the least path of resistance. However, if you try to blow the water bottle up and you don't have enough pressure behind you to do that, it's going to force its way back the other direction. Does that make sense to you, Raymond?
A lot of sense.
So we got to figure out something here. If we got too much power coming out of our generators, we want all that power because we want to be able to use that power. But at the same sense, we don't want to cram that power into our device that we're trying to run and force it to get hot trying to pull the demand that we're trying to demand off of it. So it doesn't matter whether it's our rectifiers or our fans or our batteries or even our inverter systems or our charging systems. Our charging systems only need so much power in order to be able to function. But the way that we're running our energy right now, we are actually trying to force too much power through there. And when that power doesn't have nowhere to go, it's still going to try to keep going forward because you still have forward-moving pressure behind it coming out of that generator. And the more that builds up, you build up the current. And eventually, that's why you have to have fuses and stuff, because if you push too much current through there, too much voltage, then you will cause the device to reach its thermal breakdown point and burn it up. So we figured out we can put a weaker metal in between there, and that weaker metal will fail before destroying the device that we're wanting to use. But if we figure out how to back that power up to only pull off what we need, then we can keep that device from ever getting hot. Now here's the solution to the deal. Now right now, I got a project that I'm working on, and it's pretty impressive as far as the efficiency that's going on. I'm taking a 5-volt USB charger, and I'm running a DDS signal generator. Right now, I'm running it at 60 hertz on a square wave. 60 hertz is the standard voltage that we use over here, the standard waveform that we use over here in the United States. Overseas, they probably use 50 hertz, and it's probably a sine wave. It's a cleaner wave. But a square wave is a lot stronger wave, so that's why I'm using a square wave. And so with that said, I'm pulsing a basically an AC capacitor and then into a microwave oven transformer, because I want to change that voltage. I want to change the what current is coming out of that to voltage, because all I'm wanting at this point in the game is pressure, as I want to generate no heat. I've been running the same transformer.
Yes, sir.
What?
I said yes, sir.
Oh,
I agree with you.
So I've been running this transformer for approximately about a week or two, maybe slightly less than 2 weeks now, and this transformer is still cold to the touch, as well as the prime mover, which is the signal generator, and the USB charging system are still cool to the touch. Now keep in mind, because the charger that is actually the 5-volt USB charger is actually plugged into the surge protector, it's coming from the wall, so it actually has a primary coil in there, and that itself is going to have heat because it's trying to force too much power into something and shrink that power down to a usable power that my signal generator won't burn up from. So the power bank itself, the 5-volt deal, is actually warm to the touch. Not hot, because it's not being demanded too much of, but it is warm to the touch. So there's where a loss in the system. So I could actually reduce that loss in the system by moving to a DC power bank to actually run that 5 volts instead of running what it is that I'm running. So moving right along, on the outside of that signal generator, I'm going into the secondary, which has a whole lot more turns on the wires, which is a lot thinner wire, which basically shrinks down the surface and drops the current down but raises the voltage up. So that's all I want at this point in the game, because my intentions of what to do with this voltage is, number one, move the voltage faster and smoother and cooler, because I'm not trying to push a lot of current through the circuitry. All I want to do is pressurize a storage bank so that I can actually utilize that power later on demand, however I choose, and bring back the current and the watts and such. So basically, coming out of the secondary of that microwave oven transformer, I'm running it through two different types of AC capacitors. One is a start-run capacitor, a start capacitor for a motor, which, if this was being run on a standard, the start capacitor would not be constant in the system. And the reason why I'm able to safely run it constant in the system is because I'm not putting a lot of current through there. A start capacitor in your devices are used to give a powerful punch to your electric motor to get that initial turn, and then once the motor gets up to speed, it will actually kick that start capacitor out of the circuit so that it's not running constant. However, a run capacitor is to smooth out that signal and keep a constant flow of energy going to that, so that you have a steady current flowing into your motor to run it more efficiently. And so with that said, because of the way that I'm running it, I can actually run both. I can get the powerful punch out of the start capacitor, and I can get the constant flow of the AC capacitor. Those two are actually running in series with each leg of the two wires that are actually coming out. On the microwave oven transformer, you have a ground, which is the transformer core itself, and you have a high voltage line, which is the single wire that goes out that would normally go to your magnetron on your microwave. So it's pretty much a two-wire system running into a full-wave bridge rectifier, which has three prongs on the output. But so I'm only needing two prongs. But all these capacitors are running in series, with each one of the ground wire coming from the microwave oven transformer, and the high voltage line coming from the secondary of the microwave oven transformer. So I have two lines, but each one of these capacitors are set on each of these lines running series. And so that creates a buffer between the transformer and the bridge rectifier. That keeps the transformer from getting hot, because it's not backing up on current. It's actually giving that current a place to go, so that I don't have a constant push forward. Does that make sense so far, Raymond?
So far.
So anyway, between every load, you need a buffer. Depending on how much power that you're actually trying to force through that system, will determine how large of a buffer that you actually need in order to keep that energy from trying to back up into the generator or the transformer that you're trying to run. So if I have a really large bank, then I can keep that bank completely full and be able to drain the power that I want off of that bank without causing a backup of, I want, the key to this, folks, is keeping the energy constantly moving forward. And at every stage, reducing the amount of resistance from the charge portion to the load portion. And so that means that since I'm putting out way more power than I actually need to run whatever given device, and in that process I got to put in some sort of resistance or a fuse in order to protect my device, and that means that I'm putting too much power to it. Otherwise I wouldn't need a fuse in order to try to stop that too much current flow from going in there and destroying my device. So that ought to be your first bit of verification that you're actually getting more power out of that generator than you actually think you are. Your standard car alternator or generator actually produces more power than your automobile can actually handle. So that's why even in the old style generators you had to have a voltage regulator, and in your modern style alternators you have to have a built-in voltage regulator or an external voltage regulator. That's to keep any surges or the amount of power that that generator is actually capable of producing from actually overcharging your batteries or starting a wire fire in your vehicle. So what I'm saying is not rocket science. It's based on actual science and actual physics of what's actually occurring in them. Because you imagine if you got a normal generator in your car, like the old style Volkswagen generators, and you didn't have a voltage regulator through there, running at idle speed, you might be just fine. Everything's working really good. And then you start mashing down on the gas. The faster that generator turns, the higher the voltage, the higher the frequency, the higher the pressure trying to cram through all those electrical circuits that you got. And then there you go, you got the damage. And so you need some sort of voltage regulator to ensure that that doesn't occur. So by understanding what's actually occurring with electricity and not spending all your time arguing over what electricity actually is or all the terminology or high-tech explanations with the current watts and amps that I seem to get myself in trouble with all the time, I don't care about current watts and amps, because what I'm trying to show everybody is a different method by which to use the same type of power in a more efficient manner in a different, completely different, unconventional manner than the standard model that we've actually been doing. Because every single appliance you've got is going to get hot using the conventional sense of how it's actually done. But if you knew that there was a sweet spot between how much energy that your appliance actually needed, you could quite literally build a buffer between any wall outlet, any power source, any generator source, in between your power source output to the input side of your appliance. And you can dump that energy in there and have a surplus of energy while at the same time only allowing the amount of energy necessary to go into your appliance without all the resistance that would occur by trying to cram too much in there at the same exact time, which is going to cause your appliance will accept that power. It will accept that power, but it is a give and take. It will accept that power, but it will also generate heat from the resistance of that energy being slowed down by the transformers inside that appliance or even the electrical motor themselves. So by putting a buffer in between those powers, then you can get that that device to run much cooler. And if you think of this, of every single stage of how your generator is actually functioning, you can get an incredible efficiency by the time it's all said and done. Like, for example, I mentioned I'm running a DDS signal generator. Raymond, could you mute your mic for a second? I'm running a DDS signal generator at 5 volts. According to the specs of the DDS signal generator, that without being under a load, that the output of the signal generator will produce 9 volts without being under a load. So that 9 volts is then in turn pulsing the primary of the transformer, the microwave oven transformer, which is in turn transferring that magnetic lines of flux through the secondary. But the key is that it's not oversaturating the core and causing this thing to actually generate resistance, which is going to generate heat in a transformer. Then I'm dumping that high voltage down into AC capacitors, which is now acting as the pretty much like the earth ground. Since the earth is so large, you can dump a lot of power into it and you're not going to meet the resistance. It gives a place for that energy to go so that it's not overpressurized and then something fails. So anyway, it's given a place for that energy to go because I'm actually pushing out of just this little simple unit more power than I need to run the circuit that I'm running. So I'm not slowing the energy down, but I'm giving it a place to disperse until it's actually needed by the bridge rectifier. Now, when you get to the bridge rectifier, since that energy is not backing up and meeting resistance, that means the diodes which make up the bridge rectifier are not acting like resistors now. They're accepting the voltage that's coming through as, you know, voltage pressure, but they're not generating heat like a resistor, which a diode is essentially a resistor. It only allows current to flow in one direction. So by putting it through smoothly like I'm doing, that bridge rectifier has ran for almost 2 weeks now and is not even warm to the touch. It's room temperature. It's actually cold in here, and so it's staying at the same temperature as the room. Now, from that point on, I need to bring that energy forward again. So far, I've kept constant pressure from the signal generator through the transformer, through the AC capacitors, through the bridge rectifier, and now I'm charging into DC power supplies. And the way that this is actually hooked up is really quite unique, because if you would think about a normal connection from the DC output of a bridge rectifier, normally this would be a parallel connection. Looks like I lost Raymond. I'll try to get him back here in a minute. Normally this would be a parallel connection, and so I don't know what's going on with that. Normally this would be a parallel connection. You'd hit your positive output of the rectifier to the positive input of the normal DC capacitor, and then you would hook your negative side of your bridge rectifier to the negative input of the DC capacitor. But what I've got going on here is, to instead of overpressurizing the DC capacitor, I have three other banks of DC capacitors, including ultra capacitors or boost caps, run in series with the output of the positive terminal and the input of the positive terminal on the capacitor that I'm charging. So in reality, because of the way the current's now going to be flowing, the negative side of those banks are connected to the positive side of the input side of the charge capacitor, and the positive side of the the banks are connected to the positive side of the actual bridge rectifier. So they're actually in reverse of what you normally think they were going. But you got to think about this in a line of a circle of where those electrons are actually flowing through the system. And so on the opposite side, I also have some supercapacitors which are connected from the negative side of the supercapacitor bank going through the supercapacitor bank, and the positive output of the supercapacitor bank going into the negative side of the charge capacitor. So everything is making a loop. If you think of the one bank on the right and the next bank on the left, so from the output of the bridge rectifier, there's a big circle going on. And then from the outside output of the DC charge capacitor, I actually have a what I call a parasitic load going on, which I'm actually charging a 12 volt battery, and I'm charging a circuit that requires at the very least 9 volts in order to be able to run at its maximum capacity. Looks like I lost Raymond. I'll have to try to call him back in a second. See if I can get him back. Maybe his cell phone died on him. Let's try this again. So anyway, at this stage in the game, while we're trying to get Raymond back, on the car audio capacitors that I've got, two of them ran in parallel with each other, I'm maintaining 4.67 volt surplus on those two while this is actually charging under load. On the boost caps, I'm maintaining 15.94 on the boost cap bank. Now, keep in mind that boost cap bank, before all the stuff actually kicks on, has to reach 16 volts. So I'm not too far away from 16 volts in order to be able to get that boost cap bank fully charged. Now, my battery that I'm actually charging is only at 2.72 volts, so you know that's something that I need to move that energy a little bit differently getting to. And my my actual charge capacitor is showing a 2.59 volt surplus. So just about everything in this entire deal off of a 5 volt input is actually showing a surplus. So, with that said, I'm going to throw a quick song on here and take a quick music break and see if I can get Raymond back. So, stay tuned. You're listening to Mad Science.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Yeah, I can describe the ruckus because the reason why we lost Raymond is because of exactly what we're talking about here today. Because there are certain circuit breakers that might not be designed to handle a certain amount of, power. They are set at, like, let's say a 15 amp circuit. Whenever you exceed that draw on that, whenever you're allowing too much power, or your devices are actually trying to draw too much power more than that 15 amp breaker, guess what? Click, everything goes out. I've had that happen to me here a few times, and so actually after Raymond's episode, I went and turned my heater off. So now I'm like right up underneath the blanket so I can stay warm and finish the radio show. So Raymond, essentially, in between...
You know, something that doesn't... So somewhere in my brain, it doesn't ring true, but I know it is true. Is by, you know, if you have 10,000 volts at 1 amp, or 1,000 volts at 10 amps is the same amount of energy.
Well, the key about...
Yeah, it takes less energy to produce 10,000 volts at 1 amp than it does 1,000 volts at 10 amps. It don't jive, but yet it's true.
Yeah, but see, the key about this is, Raymond, is the thermal breakdown. The thermal breakdown of the electrical wire used in your house... You know, some people, I like overkill. So if I'm going to run wiring in my house, I want it to not get hot. Even though I'm only going to be running a small breaker, such as a 15 amp breaker, I don't want to have wire that's just right at 15 amps. I don't want to take no chances because once that insulation reaches its thermal breakdown, it can short out and start a fire and burn my house down. So I like to double protect everything, put my...
That's exactly what I'm talking about. She said, that's why I lose power in here when I run my microwave and my heater at the same time, because they're on the same circuit. And the electrician that wired the place, I told him, you know, I'm not going to tell you how to do your job. I'm just going to tell you what I want. And I told him, I said, whatever code calls for the size of wire, jump two sizes bigger. In other words, if code calls for 12 gauge, run 10. If calls for 10, run 8.
All right, let me run it back to your mind.
I want it.
Yeah, I'm with you.
And then I told him to put every plug, every quadruplex plug in my office on a separate circuit. He didn't. He run them all on the same circuit.
All right, well, let me run something through your mind, even though they're all on the same circuit. All right. So let's say you got... four appliances, all right, and you normally wanted them all on a separate circuit so that none of them will interfere with each other, none of them are trying to demand too much down the wire that's going to cause breaker, the 15 amp breaker, to shut itself off because it gets hot. That's how they shut off. They get hot and bam, it kicks the breaker off, and that's a safety device so you don't burn your wire up. But let's say hypothetically, even though you're running them all on the same exact circuit, and you know that at some point that breaker switch is going to reach its thermal shutoff point, and it's going to kick. It's going to kick off. So if you got all four of these appliances running at the same time, the breaker is going to fail. And so it shuts itself off. That's to save your wire. But let's say hypothetically... Between every single load, you have a buffer, and on the all on the same exact circuit, but you have a surplus of energy to every single load. So now your wiring isn't drawing too much power. You're not asking more of that doggone breaker than it's willing to give. So when you're running all four loads on the same exact circuit, you have a buffer in between there, a storage capacity, so that each one of these has a surplus and never demand more of that wiring than it can give. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
Yes, I do. I see exactly what you're saying.
This is what I've been trying to explain to people about how this energy is moving. So you can cause a problem from either direction. You can either ask too much more depending on what your breaker is. See, if you put let's say you put a 1,000-amp breaker on that deal, that doggone power deal, it don't care. Hey, there's a gate this wide open, I'm going in, all right? So, you can get it go through. But if you limit that with a breaker that will only allow 15 amps, that means if the amperage on the other side is higher than that 15 amps, that means something on the other side is getting hot. You see what I'm saying? Even at normal use, something on the other side of that breaker is getting hot. But it's made to withstand that heat. Now, your wiring on the opposite side is not made to withstand more than, let's say, 30 amps. All right, so that 1,000 amps that you just sent through there basically causes that wire to be the resistor and meets its thermal breakdown and burns your shack down. It's not what we want to do. That's why we use these deals inside there. But from start to finish, if you pull that power off and you disperse it, allow it to get out there, and you only pull the power where you need it, just the amount that you need for any given appliance, then you're not demanding too much of the grid, you're not demanding too much of the breaker, and you're becoming more efficient because now you actually have a surplus of energy left over. You see what I'm saying here?
For example, if you've got a wire that's capable of handling 15 amp and you put a 20 amp breaker on it, then that wire, if you overload that wire, then the wire can get hot, melt the ignition, and cause a fire.
However,
if you have a wire that handles 20 amps and you only put a 15 amp breaker on it, it will never ever get warm to the touch.
Yeah, that's the key right there. And you know the safety is that if you try to draw more than that 15 amps, it'll still shut it off.
Safety with that electrician. I told him whatever the code calls for, run two gauges larger so the wire will never get hot.
Yeah, that's it.
And he did. You know what his reply was? Oh, you don't need that.
It don't matter whether you need it. It don't matter whether you need it. Because
you have no idea what I have plans for this office.
Yeah. Well, the key is it doesn't matter whether you need it or not. It's the actual fact that you're allowing a buffer between your appliances and your house, or your shop, because you're allowing a safety zone. Well, that same exact thing could be done with capacitor banks, a storage bank, before you ever even get to the load. So all four of these appliances could actually run on the same exact circuit because all of them are got continuous forward flow of energy, and they're not asking more of that breaker than that breaker is capable of doing. You see what I mean?
Exactly. Those people out there that are planning on getting a house up or building a house, you need to do that. Build in your safety buffer.
Yeah.
Go overboard. I mean, it costs pennies.
One other plus about what I'm explaining is the same reason why you have a UPS battery backup for your computer is because that instantaneous surge or whenever the power comes back on or that instantaneous drop off can actually damage circuitry inside your deal. But if you have a battery backup or a combination battery capacitor backup, then that means that you have at least enough time to shut your computer down the proper way as opposed to it just instantaneously shutting off. And then when the power flickers back on, well, then you have that sudden surge of power that might overcome the resistance in the protection units of your surge protectors or even your computer itself and cause damage from too much power being shoved in at one time. But to stabilize that power before that ever even occurs, you can shut it down, you can allow it to come up smoothly because you have a surplus of constant pressure behind it. What do you think?
Yep. Exactly.
So, understanding energy allows you to find efficiency. Because if you're trying to draw too much power, if you have any device trying to draw too much power, it's not that your battery is not capable of drawing too much power. It's just that your battery is so powerful, it's trying to push too much power forward through the load that you got going on. So by putting a buffer in between your battery and the load you're actually drawing, number one, you're going to keep your battery cooler because you're not demanding that directly from the battery. If you go out and look at some of these videos, people are using these really good 500,000 microfarad car audio capacitors in between their battery banks and their inverter systems. That is so that the capacitor, which is able to charge and discharge rapidly, is not affected thermally like the battery would be thermally affected, because batteries aren't designed, higher tech batteries aren't designed to charge and discharge rapidly like that. But a capacitor, because of its specific design, can withstand that. So you're putting the burden on top of the capacitors as opposed to the burden on top of your batteries. And the same exact concept applies whenever you're trying to draw energy off of your generator. This is why I'm able to take 5 volts and charge a system up, because I understand how voltage is pressure. And at this point in the game, I don't want the current or the watts or the amps or anything, because I'm not trying to pull that at this point. All I want to do is to see how efficiently that I can push energy forward, store it in a capacitor bank, and combinations of different types of capacitors, because once you understand which type of capacitor does which job, then, like, for example, your normal DC capacitor is a, charge and discharge really fast, really fast. Well, a boost capacitor bank is acting more like a battery, where it can still charge and discharge rapidly. It takes a little different process in order to charge it up completely. That's why the one that I've got over here is sitting at 15.97 volts now, and it was charged up with a 5 volt input, which is pretty impressive, because keep in mind, the higher pressure always wins out. You see what I'm saying? So
right.
For me to be able to push 5 volts all the way up to 15.97 volts is telling you that even if it might take me a little longer because of the method that I'm doing it, I'm still able to overcome that pressure by understanding how to use that 5 volts to ramp that pressure up and push it into those capacitor banks. So now I have 15.97 volts of stored energy ready for me to use. And that's just in the boost caps alone. In the car audio, I have 4.67 volts of stored energy ready to use. Now, if I take that, shut that system down, whatever stored energy is in there might be more, because whatever's showing on the voltmeter is actually a surplus of what's not being used by the circuitry that is actually acting as a load and draining power from the system while I'm charging. So all these charge numbers that I've been telling you about are numbers that are, while this system's under a load, the numbers continue to rise, because I understand that voltage is pressure and I'm constantly putting more pressure to it. It's the reason why that redneck hot tub worked. Reason why I was able to take a coffee pot element and heat up a water source, which is several gallons of water. I don't know how many gallons is actually in that tub, but it's quite a few gallons of water. I'd probably say at least 100 or more gallons of water in the tub, wouldn't you, Raymond?
Way more than 100 gallons. That's all your hot tub.
All right, so
it's way more than 100 gallons. It's more like about 150, 200 gallons. Maybe a little bit more than that.
Let's just say conservative 150 gallons. So,
okay.
150 gallons, and keep in mind that underneath that hot tub, it is not insulated. It's open to the air. And above the tub, it is not insulated. It is open to the air. So all that heat's going to want to transfer out through the bottom, out through the sides, out through the top, And so that's all wasted energy. All that heat that's being dispersed out there is wasted energy. But to get the work done, all I needed was that coffee pot element to keep a continuous forward motion of that heat, that temperature moving forward to get that water so hot that I could quite literally sit out there in my shorts with ice and snow outside in the dead of winter when it's below zero. I could sit inside that hot tub. The hot tub is not frozen solid ice. It is warm. I'm able to sit out there with no shirt on, just my swimming trunks, in the dead of winter in that hot tub. And actually, to a certain point, whenever you leave that element going too long, you have to shut that doggone element off because the water will get too hot for you to set in. Now, you see what's going on here?
How hot would it get if you did have it insulated?
Oh, my God. That thing would boil you out of there so rapidly because it's just like a thermos, man. If you store that, all this heat energy we're talking about, everything electric that we're talking about, you store that energy. I did a video called Physics Toy where I got a bottle with a balloon inside there, and I show you how you can use negative pressure. That's your phone, it. I show you how you can use negative pressure to actually hold energy in the other side, even though the lid's not snapped down. Then you snap the lid down, let go of the negative pressure, and now you have stored pressure energy in there. And so it's acting like a battery, and that's just air pressure. It's vacuum, it's negative pressure, it's forward pressure. And to understand how all these things function will now give you some tools to understand how electricity, if you understand how water works, if you understand about basically being able to keep a continuous forward movement of heat energy, or electricity, or even water for that matter, then you have pressure to get work done, and you can use that pressure to pressurize containers. You can store magnetism, you can store electricity, you can store water pressure, you can store heat pressure. It all basically does the same exact job. So I'm trying to explain this in the simplest terms possible. And it's kind of hard to do because modern day terminology and scientific mumbo jumbo makes it sound so complicated to the average Joe that, you know, you start whipping out all this terminology and their head just goes spinning and they don't understand what it is you're talking about. Well, I want everybody to understand what it is I'm talking about because I want everybody to be able to benefit from this knowledge. Right now, we have every single thing necessary to be able to become at least incredibly efficient. That means you're going to save money on your energy usage because you're going to understand that if I plug any device into the wall, that device is going to demand from that power source a certain amount of power in order to do its job. Well, once it's done doing its job, but it's still plugged in, it's still generating heat. And the longer I leave that plugged in, it's generating heat. And that heat is lost energy unless you're using that heat to heat your house. Now, if your home is super insulated, then that means that heat energy is just adding to less energy that you got to turn your thermos up on, or your thermostat up on for your main heater. But even at that, you don't want that heat in that particular device because that heat will eventually cause the windings in the primary or even the electrical parts in the device that actually turns it from AC to DC current. It will get those hot. They will reach their thermal breakdown and they will fail and you got to go out and buy you a new phone charger. You see what I'm saying? So by understanding that, that's a wasted heat energy that you've got going on. It's constantly drawing power as long as it's connected to the grid. But if you put a buffer in between there, which slows down that thermal problem that you've got going on, your transformer's not going to get hot like it did before. You see what I mean? Because it's not demanding either from either the transformer or the power is not, you're not trying to push too much power into it. The best case scenario is you unplug those transformers when you're not using them, and they won't get hot. They won't be wasting energy. But if you're trying to build an alternative energy device and you want this thing to be incredibly efficient, then you got to understand the simple of what's actually occurring with electricity. So when we're using this power, that generator, I don't care if it's a 2,500 watt generator all the way up to a 6,000 or higher watt generator, that generator is capable of pushing out a whole lot more power than you will ever use out of that generator in the conventional sense. But if you figure out what it is that I'm talking about and you give that energy a place to flow freely, all right? Imagine a waterfall like Niagara Falls. When all that water is coming down and there's only so much space at the bottom of that waterfall for that energy to disperse at. So whenever you look down at the base of that waterfall, you're like, my God, I wouldn't want to fall in there because it's so turbulent. Everything's just chaotic and all that. But imagine if you took that same spot and you expanded it out to where all that energy had a wide space to go. At the base of that bottom of that waterfall, even as large as it is, if that energy had a space to disperse out, you wouldn't see nowhere near the disturbance at the bottom. You see what I mean? You're going to allow that energy to flow. It's still all there. It's still all pressure. It's moving forward. It's going down the river and all that. And you can see the difference between, you know, the wide river as opposed to the narrow river. As when you got a wide river, you got a lot of current flow. When you got a thinner river, you got a whole lot of water pressure going on because it's all being crammed down one single spot where now it increases that turbulence and the resistance for anything that's in the way, rocks, you and the canoe or whatever. And so that will make it harder for you to paddle upstream because of all that high pressure that's underneath you. So when you understand that, then you got to have a pressure that's able to overcome the pressure that you're going against. That's the same exact thing that electricity is doing at the same time. So, with that said, Raymond, you still there? You on the phone? I think Raymond's on the phone. He's talking to his broker.
I'm off the phone. I just turned my heater off, turned the microwave on, make me a cup of coffee. Go ahead.
All right.
And so far, you're right.
So anyway, to become more efficient, you got some sort of buzzing going on. Is that your microwave?
Yep, that's it. Let me turn my mic off.
All right.
Get done. I'll be back in about a minute.
All right. It's duct tape and baling wire here at Mad Science, folks. Never forget that. But either way, the information that we're trying to share with you is good information. So, if you're not demanding too much from the generator, you can get that generator to not bog down, which means if you got a gasoline engine running that generator head, then that means that gasoline engine's not going to have to work near as hard. So if you're pulling power out and you're allowing that power to flow freely through a large storage bank, you give yourself a surplus of power, and until the pressure in your storage bank overcomes the pressure of the output of that generator, then that generator is not going to have to work hard. But once it gets to the point, if you're not pulling the power off fast enough from that power bank, then that's when your generator will begin to bog down, because that's when your generator will meet resistance. And so if you got wiring that's going from, let's say, your battery to your inverter, and it begins to get hot, that's because you're trying to actually push too much power at one time, or your inverter is trying to draw too much power through a resistance. It needs that power in order to run. So it's either forward resistance or it's even going to be reverse resistance through that wire that is going to cause that heat to be generated. And if you smoothly transition that power from your battery to your inverter by putting a buffer in between there, then you allow that energy to flow freely through there, and it's not trying to force it one way or another. It's just allowing the nature to do what nature does best. It allows that flow to go smoothly through. So between every single load of every single thing that's either asking for or demanding from whatever, pushing once push power one way, that power, when you get pressure built up in a battery, just like that podcast explained, it wants to go to the other side. These electrons, if you subscribe to the electron theory, they don't want to be next to each other. They are pressurized against each other. They want to go, you know, from negative to positive. They want to get out of there. They want to travel. So as soon as you open the gate, which is opening a path, giving them a path to ground, they're going to take the path of least resistance. So if you got a resistor on one wire, it's going to go down the wire that doesn't have the resistor first. So you can actually guide that energy and time it out to go where you want it, when you want it to go. So I don't want it to go down to the right, so I'm going to put a resistor over there so it has to reach this much power before it actually go that way. I want it to go this way. But if the power backs up over on the left side, now that resistance will overcome that diode and allow the power to go to the right instead of to the left. You see what I'm saying? That's how, if you can guide this energy and you understand how this energy is actually traveling, that when you meet resistance, you basically generate friction because the energy is still coming in behind it. It's not stopping. While your generator's turning, it's not stopping. Probably the best and most efficient way to run any generator would be to have that generator pulse on, pulse off, pulse on, pulse off, at whatever rate you needed it to keep a constant flow forward. So if you built a generator and you had almost like a blinker switch, and you could actually adjust this blinker switch. Most modern day blinker switches are thermally activated, so you have to get some current flow through there. The little switch gets hot, and then it will make the connection and turn your light on and off, on and off, on and off. Well, by figuring out a way to make a pulse style where the generator, the only time the generator's pushing out power is when you tell it to. So when your engine's running, all you're doing is pulsing that generator on and off, on and off. But you do it at whatever level that you need to only get that smooth flow of forward-moving electrons going in one direction. This will ensure that your generator is never putting out more power than it needs to. And if you actually look at how, to some extent, the alternator or even the generator with a built-in voltage regulator or an external voltage regulator actually functions, it turns your alternator on and off. It turns your generator on and off. That actually ain't turning them off as far as the amount of power that's coming at them. It breaks the circuit so that you're not constantly pushing power through to there until the battery gets to a certain level and demands more energy to come to it. But by doing it this way, then that means your generator isn't staying on continuously. And so by understanding that, now you can actually control the output of your generator and keep your generator from ever even getting hot, because the moment that switch comes on, there's a sudden surge of power coming through there. And if you got a buffer from that sudden surge of power, you dump all that energy out there, and then on the opposite side where you're drawing that load, you got a smooth, steady flow of that energy that you want to be using for your appliances. So we got methods by which we can actually make the prime mover, which is either an electric motor driving force to the generator head, where that electric motor doesn't have to work hard. Or if it's a gasoline or diesel engine, or even wind or hydroelectric power for that matter. You know, you can let that thing spin freely all the way down while the water's going, but if you don't need that much power, then you can actually regulate when that doggone generator is actually giving you energy. You can make and break the circuit right in the generator itself. So It's all about how you engineer your circuits from this point on, because now you have an understanding of how that energy is flowing and what it is that causes that energy to cause you problems, such as getting hot, causing thermal breakdown, or even bogging the generator down itself. By putting a buffer between that generator, you're not allowing for that backup of energy. The moment that energy backs up, you invoke the lens effect and the second magnetic field that acts like a brake on the armature, and you don't want that, because that makes your generator head have to work harder, it makes your prime mover have to work harder, and so you only want to take off the energy that you need. But if you need a lot of energy, you allow that energy from that generator to put its maximum out there. And when I say put its maximum out there, you dump it out there like that example that I gave you of the waterfall, where you allow it to jump out there into a large, large bank. All right, now your load will still run off of that large bank. It don't have to have that exact amount voltage-wise as it would be, you know, when you're trying to regulate the power exactly going into your load, because you have a surplus of that power. And then you can allow that energy to go into your load, whatever you need, without causing it to have resistance, which trying to cram too much power in through that load at one time is what is going to end up causing it to fail. You still there, Raymond? Huh. He's got his mic muted.
Yeah, dude. I see exactly what you're talking about. In fact, I like to compare water or hydraulics with electricity. And I'm designing something in my head that explains exactly what you're talking about.
Yep.
I mean, it's really neat. I mean,
you said something a long time ago about moving water. I said you said something a long time ago about moving water with steam instead of trying to pump it as a liquid. And that's kind of kind of like the same example. So I changed it from a liquid to steam, more or less, because I want the voltage, I want the steam pressure, but I don't want the current at this point, because current is what's causing me to get hot. I'm running my MOSFETs, my transistors, and my diodes and resistors are getting too hot because I'm trying to cram too much current through them. And if I'm having to limit it with a resistor to begin with in order to not destroy my circuitry, then that ought to tell you that I'm putting too much power to it. You see what I mean?
Yes, exactly. And the thing is, when you say comparing steam, like you can move steam easier than you can move water, the thing is, steam doesn't have to be hot. I have videos on YouTube showing me producing steam at 60 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yep.
It's water. Steam.
Water will boil.
Doesn't have to be hot. Water. And it will move.
Yep. So, that's where your cold steam turbine came in.
Exactly. So, right on the nose, my friend.
Cold steam turbine, cold electricity, basically, understanding. Right now, we're running things hot. All right, we're on the verge of breakdown every single day because we got to have cooling fans on everything, because the way that the current's being shoved through there, you want to get your processors a lot of power to be able to do things, but in order for that, you got to trade off, because that constant switching and trying to, you know, take all this power is generating a lot of wasted heat. And so if you guide that energy to where you want it to go, if it only takes so many volts as pressure wise to actually cause a transistor to kick on, then why would you want to shove a whole bunch of current through that same transistor? You see what I mean?
If
you could keep a transistor cool, it will never ever fail until it biodegrades, until the material, you know, either oxidizes or something goes awry naturally with it, but it won't fail due to thermal breakdown if you can keep that thing cool. And that's the same thing for every single thing. Your coatings on your electrical wire, your oil, the viscosity, the thickness of your oil. You know, you keep that thermal breakdown in mind when you're designing your machinery or you're designing your electronics. You keep the thermal breakdown. You find the weakest point in your thermal breakdown of your system, and that's where you work from. Work from that point on, and it will tell you exactly where you can go. Now, if you can resolve that thermal breakdown with a different material to increase its thermal breakdown, then you would go to the next part that would be the weakest point. You see what I mean?
See exactly what you mean.
So if it can't reach its thermal breakdown, it won't fail. And so,
you know,
go
the
ahead.
Thing is, I think some people are not getting the idea. The idea is sometimes you want heat, and other times you don't. Well, when you don't want heat and there's heat, figure out how to do away with the heat.
Well,
without actually just throwing it away.
You just hit another key point.
You want heat, then you want resistance. That's when you use nichrome wire or some other kind of resistor.
Yeah.
So you can actually produce heat. But, like, for example, in a toaster, you want heat. So you're using electricity to produce the heat. But in a blender, you don't want heat. But you're going to get it.
Let me put something on your brain. Anything can be scaled up, can be scaled down. I got some nichrome wire. I can't read it because my eyes ain't focused in on it, but I can't remember what gauge this wire is. But this particular, it's pretty decent thickness. It's not super thick, but it's basically designed for a certain amount of current flow to resist current. All right, that's nichrome wire. It's going to resist current. And at that thickness, it could probably withstand a whole lot of current before it actually burns in half. All
right? Right.
Now imagine if I want to be able to run, some nichrome wire, but I don't want to use so much current. What's to stop me from taking that same type of material and making a super, super thin nichrome wire that will resist voltage, because in voltage there is some amount of current. You see what I mean?
Yes, yes.
So
you and I discussed it off the air.
Yeah. So essentially you would have a hair thin wire that just voltage alone would produce heat. Now, the amount of heat that you could get out of it would be, you know, pretty impressive if you had, let's say, a king-size blanket grid of really super thin wire. You see what I mean?
Right.
Now, that's not going to burn in half because you're never going to exceed the amount of resistance that it can actually do. But the fact that it is actually going to resist the current flow, even though it's minuscule inside just voltage, which is the pressure, you're putting too much pressure through there because it's smaller. You see what I mean?
Yep.
So it's all about how we engineer stuff. You know? And if we understand how the energy is actually moving and what is actual causes and effects of everything that's going on, then now we can wisely engineer things to be incredibly efficient. But in the meantime, even with the standard systems that we got, we have the knowledge on how to use stored energy to act as a buffer between our loads so that, you know, if you're just running your normal outlet, let's say 110-volt outlet, and instead of you draining straight off of that 110-volt outlet, you store that power before you ever even use it, all right? So now your appliance isn't relying on that outlet anymore. It's only relying on the stored energy. And so if you got enough stored energy, the outlet, it's just continuously putting out its 110. It's not drawing 110 to 115 to 120, depending on when that appliance begins to get hot in the primary. It, when it gets hot, it's actually going to work that plug in harder. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. I see exactly what you're saying.
So by putting a buffer in between there, all that deal keeps the appliance cooler because it's not got an abundance of continuous power being shoved into it. It's tapped into the bank, and so it only takes away what it needs. If the bank's large enough, then it's never going to ask more than it needs, and it's never got more energy pulling in. And if your appliance temperature starts to raise up, you can have that bank set up to go ahead and send some of that energy out to another secondary deal, such as wait a second, I need a little bit of light over here for a while. I'll just guide that energy over to that light over there. And so that sends that excess energy in your power bank over to that light and keeps your primary inside your transformer from ever getting hot, because it's not meeting that resistance by trying to shove too much power through it at one time. You still have your AC wave, no matter which direction it's going. You still have your AC wave, because that's what capacitors do. It'd be like a rolling wave through the bank. And when it finally gets to it, you still got the same frequency. Everything's just exact. It just smoothed it out. And even if you have to send it to the right over to a lighting system, because the temperature sensor on your transformer just said, wait, I'm getting up to 90 degrees Fahrenheit, so that's too hot. Let's send some power somewhere else. Does that make sense to you?
That makes perfect sense, yes.
So that's perfect. What I'm trying to tell people. Your generators are capable of doing so much more, but we're trying to force that power down systems, and that as much energy as you're running on that generator, it continuously puts out constantly. It's never going to stop putting out that much power. Your batteries aren't capable of receiving that power that quickly under those circumstances. But there's a way to change that energy to, you know how they have battery chargers out there? They call them speed chargers or something like that. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Fast charging systems?
On a generator, isn't that what they're down there for?
Yeah, well, on a fast charger system, it actually takes it, instead of trying to push current into your battery, it will ramp up the frequency and push voltage, high frequency into that battery so that your battery can charge faster than it would normally. You see what I mean?
Right.
Yeah, because right. Your battery is resisting that current, so your battery is getting hot, and the hotter that battery gets, the more pressure builds up in that battery, and the harder it is to keep that battery full. And you can't
right.
You can't shove all that current in there at one time, because the battery will get too hot, and it'll burn the battery up. So
right.
In order to make a speedy charger, a fast charger, they take the energy that you would normally be putting in the battery. They slow down the current, ramp up the voltage, because voltage will travel easier without the resistance, and it's not fighting the battery, and the only thing the battery sees is electron flow and feels the pressure building up. It doesn't feel a sudden current surge that's trying to be forced in between there. It doesn't.
Isn't that exactly what you and I discussed off the air?
Yep.
Off the air of the radio show. That it takes less energy to make 10,000 volts at 1 amp than it does to make to produce 1,000 volts at 10 amps,
yep.
Yet it is the same amount of power.
Well,
it's
right
the same
now,
amount of total energy,
right.
But it takes less energy to produce.
Right,
and that's
now,
exactly what you're talking about. It's producing the same amount, but with less energy to produce it, and you're throwing it into a bigger container.
Right now, my boost pack bank is at 16.01 volts. My car audio bank, which is actually part of a parasitic load, because it actually has circuitry in there that's running and has to get to a certain voltage before it will kick on, is still maintaining 4.66 volts. My battery, which is also under a load, is actually producing 2.72 volts, and my capacitor bank on the other side is maintaining 2.59 volts. So all of this was done with forward pressure voltage alone, starting from a 5 volt input. What do you think of that?
Right. Yep. I like it.
All right, well, we can do one of two things. You can either take over the radio show, or I got to throw on a song, because I got to go take a nature break, because the coffee gets you.
Right.
So what you want? Music break, or do you want to take over the show and tell something about your...
Take a music break. I'm not very good on my own.
Yeah, you might get in trouble while we're gone.
But tell me.
All right, folks, we'll be back. Old Crazy Hair Shaziz drank too much coffee, so I'm going to play a quick song and make a quick run, and I'll be right back. Peace and love. Stay tuned.
While you're gone, so your room can warm up a little bit.
Yeah.
There you go.
Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations. To boldly go where no man has gone before.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
All righty then. May said, gotta leave. See you next time, May. Thanks. All right, so basically, if you understand what it is we've been explaining to you today, you understand how plumbing works. Because in plumbing, you've got valves which stop the water or start the water. You got valves that are pressure sensitive that will wait till it gets to a certain pressure before it opens up and allows the water to go one way. And you got all different types of valves that are, you know, check valves, gate valves, pressure valves, and all that kind of stuff. So that you can control where you want your water flow to go in your plumbing. And at what pressure. And at what time you actually want the water to go. So the same thing applies with electricity. So if I don't want energy going to a certain area at one time, I can put a diode in there that has a breakdown voltage of whatever. And until it actually reaches that breakdown voltage, you won't even be able to go that way. So I can send it off another direction. So if I get one container that finally reaches 16.2 volts, and once it gets past that, that extra voltage is going to go past it. It's going to open that pressure valve, which is the diode, and it's going to send the energy in the other direction and allow a system over there to charge. So we can actually guide electricity to wherever we want it to go. We can actually guide the magnetic field to wherever we want it to go. That's why I played that video from Tin Man Power. And he always does some brilliant work, so if you get a chance to go over and subscribe to his YouTube, that would be cool. So, anyway, he showed how to make a monopole magnet. And not by connecting the metal to the magnet, but putting the metal in the field. Scotty Sarvin said, what's all that ruckus? That's Raymond. He's always creating a ruckus. Wasn't me. I didn't do it. Just because I'm crazy haired shaziz don't mean I'm guilty, man. So anyway, in order to reach efficiency, electricity and efficiency go hand in hand once you understand how that energy is actually traveling. We know what science says, we know what the physics say, and so all we got to do is understand that, maybe guide the energy where we want it to go. And by knowing that how that actual resistance actually produces heat, that means if you're putting too much current to any given electrical device, or you're demanding too much at any given time from any electrical device. If that electrical device on the input side is getting more power than it needs, it's going to get hot. So you have to have resistors and stuff like that in order to act as a buffer between there. But resistors produce heat when that current's coming through there. And you don't want that heat and that particular incident. And even on the opposite side of the spectrum, when you're drawing power from any given device, if it is demanding too much from that, then it will also generate heat by trying to pull too much current. Either direction, push or pull, it will generate resistance, which will generate heat. You're either pushing too much to it, or you're demanding too much from it. So if you have a device and you allow that energy to flow in there on a constant rate, and you just ensure that that energy always has a place to go, and you have a surplus between your load and your generator, that means that your generator won't have to work hard in order to maintain that. It's the redneck hot tub. Alright, we got to figure out a way to put that into the redneck hot tub theoretical science. What do you think?
I love it.
So, I'm able to get in a hot tub in the dead of winter in my swimming shorts and not freeze to death. All right, I'm sitting in the water in the dead of winter, and I'm not freezing to death, even though this thing is not insulated in any direction. So that means all that heat energy is escaping out into the atmosphere. It's trying to transfer to that water. The cold is trying to transfer to that water. You see what I mean? Actually, heat trying to go to cold, but nonetheless, as long as that heat pressure is going, is constantly keep coming in, it can never get cold. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
And once you understand heat, you understand pressure, you keep a constant flow going. So if you got a generator that's only capable of producing 2,500 watts, you take that same generator, you push that energy out into a large bank. Give that 2,500 watts a free roam. I mean, plenty of space to go. You're still going to have 2,500 watts on the other side. You're just going to get a surplus because that 2,500 watts is going to continue to pressurize that container and continue to pressurize it until that container gets pressurized higher and the generator is pushing the energy out. Then that generator will never have to work hard. It's the same example of blowing up a balloon or blowing up a hot water bottle. You try to blow up a balloon, the balloon can only withstand so much pressure, and it will explode and release all that pressure out into the atmosphere. The hot water bottle, on the other hand, because it's thicker and a heavier deal, the harder you blow on that thing, when you finally get it up to its maximum where you can't push any farther, you have no more pressure in your lungs to try to force past that hot water bottle. And I've actually seen videos where people have had strong enough lung strength to blow up a hot water bottle. That's crazy. But I wouldn't suggest it. Because when you're pushing all that pressure, the higher pressure is always going to win out. And so it's going to start pushing its way backwards and could explode your lungs if you try too hard. You see what I mean?
Yep, but that I definitely understand.
Well, that's how the energy's traveling. And if you give that energy a place to go, you'll still have your 2,500 watts. You haven't lost anything. Energy can neither be created nor destroyed. That was the physics. That was their science, their physics. That energy can neither be created nor destroyed. So where does it go? It goes where you tell it to go if you want to be efficient. Otherwise, you will generate waste and it will go out into the atmosphere. It will cause your devices to get hot and fail. And so when you realize this and you want to keep that forward motion of that power, you want to pull that energy away from the generator. Allow the generator to work freely. If it's working freely, it will never bog down on you. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Well, let's go to the hot water bottle. Let's say you put a pressure release valve on that hot water bottle, and the pressure releases at 100 psi. Well, you don't need 100 psi.
No.
So you're going to get hurt. You're going to hurt whatever it is you're trying to drive, your pneumatic tool.
Yep.
So once you speak to 100 psi, but you're putting in 102, you can blow that bottle up.
Yeah.
But you got a 100 pound psi relief valve that goes to another hot water bottle.
Well, hold on. You can take that same example and you can set it like your average air tool, your pneumatic tools around about 60 psi. So if you got 100 psi capability, but you got your valve set at 60 psi, and you got enough pressure coming in to keep a constant flow of energy in there. Every time it hits 60 psi, your pneumatic tool will turn over. You see what I mean?
Right, but here's the thing. Let's say you're not using that tool, but you're still producing that 102 psi.
Yeah.
So now all of a sudden your 100 pound relief valve is releasing the excess. But what I'm saying is that excess goes into another bottle.
That's right.
Now all of a sudden pumping, bam! So you've got 2 psi going into another bottle that's empty.
It's
blowing up. So eventually, because you haven't been using that tool, that bottle it fills up. So now you still use it, so you have 101 psi on it. So that when it hits 101, then it goes to a third bottle.
That's right.
But now all of a sudden, the third bottle is half full, but you're opening a valve to the first bottle, right?
Yep, and you have a surplus.
Yes, now all of a sudden, but the your relief valve, not your relief valve, but your valve that you open to use your tool is passed to all three bottles.
That's it. Now you have a surplus. That's the same
exact
concept.
But you're only drawing out of the first bottle.
That's right.
Because the other two bottles aren't high enough to break through their relief valve.
So when
you see what I'm saying?
When your temperature sensor on your battery reaches a certain temperature, it will turn a switch on that will open a secondary bank of capacitors and allow that current to instead flow into the one that's fully charged, flow into the next one. And so you will do that while keeping a constant flow. When your battery temperature goes back down, it'll shut that off and it'll level that system out. So you can have multiple banks. You can have 1,000 banks in a row, and each one of them will kick on when the temperature gets to a certain level. When the pressure gets to a certain level in that capacitor bank, then it will shift it over to the next one in line, and so you will continuously gain a surplus without ever putting that generator or inverter under a load.
Right. Exactly. And the second, third hot water bottle, you don't even use it until the first bottle drops down to their pressure and equalizes. Then
that's
you're
right.
Going out of the first and the second.
They have low voltage battery protector circuits that will actually take your battery, and when your battery is at full charge, it'll have a relay on, and so it will allow the current to flow from your battery to the load. But when your battery gets down to a certain level, it will actually shut the power off to the load, which means your motor would stop turning, but your battery would start to charge again. So you could actually protect the battery with these circuits so that you can continuously keep your battery up, and the only time that your battery would ever, your load would ever be on is whenever your battery was fully charged. Well, that same circuit could be used in parallel with another battery so that when the one battery is off because it's being charged, the next battery in line is carrying the load. So it's fully charged, it's on, and it's running your load. So in reality, your load never shuts off. It actually stays running because when the one shuts off, the other one's still on because it's full charge. And in that, you can guide the energy that you're charging your battery in the same fashion to whichever battery needs the electricity at any given time.
Right.
So, it may be a case that you got 10 batteries in line, but one of those 10 batteries is all that it takes to run your load. As long as that battery is fully charged, none of the other 10 batteries are being used. But the moment that battery gets low, it'll shut itself off and start the next one in line. Meanwhile, while you're running off of that one, the first one is being recharged by your system and not having to work hard to do so.
Exactly.
This is efficiency, folks. This is what I've been trying to explain to you. It's really hard to try to find all the terminology to match up with everything that mainstream science and electronic engineers and electricians are trying to say. But if you understand what I'm saying, you can find the sweet spot in every single generator, and you can have maybe two batteries would be all it would take in order to have one constantly running your load. It's not getting hot because you're using a buffer between it, but it's still being able to maintain all the energy forward that you need to run whatever it is that you want to run, at the same time continuously charging the system. So, with incredible efficiency means that your appliances are going to last longer because they're not going to reach the thermal breakdown, so therefore they will not fail. It means that you're going to basically be able to, if you're having to buy power off the grid, once that power gets into your light socket, because the power company themselves will tell you, anything on the other side of that meter is your responsibility. It belongs to you. So once you buy the electricity and it comes into your house, you have paid for that electricity. Whatever you use, that is your electricity. And anything that fails between that point, they will not take care of. Anything that fails on their side of, they're obligated to take care of it because they're your provider and they're supposed to maintain their equipment. So if you take that electricity, for say, you got a 110-volt outlet, you're able to store that as a surplus so that even if the power grid goes down, you're not paying for that electricity anymore. You already paid for it once, but if you do it in such an incredibly efficient manner that it doesn't spin that thing like a top every time you use it, then you're going to save on money. You see what I mean?
Right. That's exactly what you mean, man.
So if you can build a home generator that requires 120 volts to run it at whatever amperage, and that's all it drains, but for some reason it puts out a heck of a lot more, enough to run your entire house, you haven't stolen anything. You paid for every bit of electricity that you got. What do you think?
I think you're right. You know, the thing is, people don't use electricity 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for 52 weeks out of the year. Well, you only use it as you need it. But the thing is, you can make it 24 hours a day.
You
can produce. You can't create, but you can produce electricity 24 hours a day, very simply.
Do you remember that low voltage circuit that I mentioned?
Yep.
Well, the same could be done with any transformer you got. If that transformer's drawing a load, a circuit can actually detect when that transformer is at, you know, its normal operating temperature under a load as opposed to its operating temperature outside of a load or the actual current draw or whatever. And so if you unplug your phone from the transformer, it will automatically shut that circuit off so that your primary on your transformer is not draining power on the grid. It will do it for you. It won't ask you. It just shut it off. You're not using it, so why pay power for it? You break the circuit, and then the moment it detects that you plugged it back in, then it provides the power for you. So you can actually build smart systems for your buffer between your input from your grid power from the wall socket. You can build a buffer that will be a smart buffer that when you turn your TV off, if you're actually not using the TV, it will actually shut it down. And most computers, and maybe even some modern TVs, have a memory in them with a keep-alive battery that will keep your channels and everything all maintained. Otherwise, you might have to scan for channels every time your TV comes on, which could be obnoxious, but there are methods by which you can supply enough energy to that TV so it never loses its memory, but at the same time, not allowing that excess wasted energy for whatever transformers inside of that appliance to be draining when the TV is not in use. What do you think?
I need to ask you a question, and I'd like for the listeners, anybody that knows that it can be done, to respond, please. Look, they designed motors in the United States to run on 110 to 120 volts at, say, for example, 10 amps. Would it be possible, or is it possible, to design an electric motor that runs on 11 to 1200 volts at 1 amp? Because you're talking the exact same energy. However, to produce 110 volts, 110 to 120 volts at 10 amps, takes more energy to produce that than it does to produce electricity at 11 to 1200 volts at 1 amp.
Well, if you want an answer to your question,
yes.
I pulsed a microwave oven transformer, and I tried to run a little microwave oven fan, a little induction style fan, directly off of the high voltage alone.
Right.
It would not run. Now, I put an AC capacitor in series with that same motor, and it turned right on. That is because...
Okay, that's what I'm talking about. Now, to take 110 volts at 10 amps and to use a transformer to boost it up, no, that's the wrong way to go because you lose energy doing that.
That's right.
But to actually build a generator that will produce 1100 volts at 1 amp It takes less energy to turn that generator than it does to turn the generator that makes 110 volts at 10 amps.
That's right. And so the answer to your question is yes, you can run it on voltage alone, but you have to run that voltage into a bank to build up the pressure to give you back the amount of current necessary to actually run that fan. And that's what I did with
that. Okay, that's what I'm talking about, because it is possible.
Yes, it is.
It is possible to build a generator to produce high voltage, low amperage.
That's right.
But if you can use that directly without converting it back down,
yeah,
then
that's
you actually use less energy input to run that same motor.
That's it. Now you figured out why it is that I've been specifically trying to point out voltage alone is because what I'm doing here with 5 volts should not be possible on the conventional sense. I've got plenty of storage right now. I can actually run an electric motor real time on this system because I've got the surplus voltage available. Now, depending on how large of an electric motor that I put on there will determine how much time that I got on the capacity of the bank. But nonetheless, it's just like a battery in your car. You only have so much voltage and so much stored pressure or tension inside that battery. And once that runs out, everything balances itself out. Your battery's down. But if you're only pushing voltage, your generator doesn't have to work hard. And you don't have to try to step it down.
That's my point.
Yeah.
My point is, you can build a generator that will produce 10,000 volts at 1/10 of an amp, and that generator will draw way less energy. It will take less energy, a whole bunch less energy, than to turn a generator to produce 110 volts at 10 amps.
Yep.
And you see what I'm saying?
And that's why I'm saying, if your generator is capable, if it says on the label that, let's say, like you got one that says its peak is 6,000 volts. It can handle 6,000 watts or whatever. All right. But normal operating with a bunch of heavy loads on there, it could be multitudes times lower than 6,000. You're not getting a full 6,000. You might only get 4,500 normal run with a full load. You see what I mean? That's because the generator's bogged down. But if it says that you have 6,000 watts that thing is capable of, you should be able to get not just the 6,000 watts, but if you store it properly before you use it, you can get a large enough surplus to exceed 6,000 watts. And it's not because you're getting out more than you're putting in, it's because you're storing it ahead of time.
Right. That's the whole secret right there.
Yeah.
Storage ahead of time.
That's what I'm doing with 5 volts. See, Raymond, I've got 5 volts that has charged a boost capacitor bank up to 16.5 volts. Now, obviously, I can't get 16.5 volts directly out of that doggone USB charger, but you can see it. It's right there on the voltmeter. That thing is charged up to 16.5 volts. And that's just the boost capacitors. The audio capacitors are sitting at 4.66 surplus. The battery itself is only at 2.72 surplus. And one of the capacitor banks is only at 2.59 surplus. But keep in mind, every number that I read out to you is all surplus energy, because the actual load itself requires a certain amount of energy to do a certain amount of work. So whatever is not being used by that circuit is showing up on that voltmeter. See what I mean?
Right.
So
yes.
I took 5 volts and I turned it into 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, about 26 or 27, give or take, because I just kind of rounded numbers up, around about, let's just say, conservative, 25 volts off of a 5-volt USB charger of surplus energy. While this is under a load, it's actually using energy. So it's still charging while using energy, but that's the surplus numbers that I have available.
Right.
And that's what I'm talking about. Because if you do the same exact thing, that 6,500-watt generator is capable of a larger amount of kilowatts or voltage, output wattage, if it says you can get 6,000 volts out of that, you can't get more than 6,000 volts out of that. But if you take that energy and you use that 6,000 volts to pressurize a large bank, you can get 10 kilovolts out of that 6,000 because you're not actually trying to draw it direct. You're actually using that to pressurize a storage bank that is now capable, when it's fully charged, of 10,000 volts, 10,000 watts. You see what I mean?
Right.
And I'm proving it.
You're definitely on to something here, Suzanne. You're right on the lines of what I've been thinking, but you're more detailed.
Well, I'm proving it. It's happening. And I got to talk to a friend of mine. He's working on a system, but he says he's getting a voltage decrease somewhere, and so that means we got a leak somewhere. We got to find that leak and plug it.
You know how an induction motor works, right?
Yeah.
All right. It just like anything, if you use power of some kind to do work, if you do the work, it produces the power. So in other words, if you use electricity to turn an induction motor, it does work. But yeah, if you work to turn the induction motor, it will produce electricity, power.
But if you tune that thing back...
And I've done this myself several times. Many times. It put magnets in a induction motor and turned it into a generator.
Yep.
But the thing is, just in the past year or two, it has slowly dawned on me that the induction motor is a generator. You don't need to put magnets in it. And it turns so easy, it's unbelievable. I mean, you can take a 10 horsepower, 110 volt, 10 horsepower motor, induction motor, turn it by hand, past its RPMs, and it will produce voltage beyond 110 volts.
Yep.
A very low amperage.
But that's the key.
But it takes so little energy to turn it up that speed. It's unreal.
Yep.
It's unbelievable how little energy it takes to turn an induction motor that fast.
But if you always realize that voltage is pressure, and pressure is what gets work done, and you know you can't run directly off of that generator because of that it doesn't have the current required to run certain things, so you store that pressure and then use it. And if you got enough high voltages coming in simultaneously, because it doesn't care where this electricity is coming from. All right, it's going to go to the least path of resistance, which is your large storage bank, and it's going to pressurize it, and it will pressurize it faster because you got more high voltage coming in from multiple different directions, and so you can get that thing to pressurize so rapidly that you can run real-time loads that do require a lot of current flow to run. They'll be able to run on demand, but the key is they will run cooler because they won't be trying to draw too much. Or vice versa, demand one way or another. You see what I mean? They won't be meeting a resistance. You can tune that thing down so that that motor is running cooler because you only need so much magnetic flux to turn that motor. It don't need all that current, but it's getting all that current. That's why it's getting hot. It's getting too much power. That's the key. So we can make them incredibly efficient. I mean ridiculously efficient.
Yep.
And once you got that figured out, you'll know how to beat the man at their own game.
Yeah.
If you want to get off the power grid, folks, it's simple. You don't have to have a massive solar array once you understand what it is that I just told you. If you got a generator that will run, or an electric motor that will run off of a 40-watt solar panel, and you start from there, and you take, instead of trying to pull wattage and amperage and current off of that, you use that 40-watt solar panel to ramp that voltage up as high as you can get it to go. And then you dump that voltage down into a massive storage bank, and then run your inverters on the opposite side. You will be surprised at how cool your batteries stay, you will be surprised at how much you could actually run off a 140 watt panel. I'm doing 5 volts. I got 16.6 volt surplus. That's pretty impressive. And I did it all with voltage, Raymond.
Yep.
This is what I've been trying to point out to everybody. This is why I keep getting myself in trouble, because I know the standard model says you got to have current watts and amps. Alright? Yep. And people get angry when you say, no, you don't got to have current watts and amps. Not at this stage in the game. What I'm working on does not require current watts and amps. It requires high voltage, high frequency, so that that energy can skim, whether it be through a plasma reactor energizing that gas into the fourth state of matter producing light and heat, that I could then in turn transfer back into usable energy on the opposite side via, you know, heat
and water. Storage bank, and then run your inverters on the opposite side.
That?
You will be surprised at how cool your batteries stay. You will be surprised at how much you could actually run off a 140 watt panel.
That was me.
It's a repeat of yourself, man. What happened?
Yeah, I had the super chat open, but certain programs don't want to allow that doggone. It just now kicked on. The radio player just now kicked on. I opened that before I even started the show. It didn't come on until just now. Scotty Sovereign said, I've managed to persuade Mark Steele, the 5G guy, to do a show on Thursday at 9 UK, running for 3 weeks starting next Thursday. Woohoo! Alright, so we got a good show going on over there at Scotty Sovereign's People for People and I think Wolf Spirit Radio. So, I think he's already put the time down there. 9 UK. Alright, so this Central Time, Standard Time, Eastern Time, that all gets me confused, man. But when it comes to energy and mechanics, I think I'm alright. What do you think, Raymond?
I think you're right. I know it.
Alright, so folks, what I've been trying to help you guys and gals out there is give you a little bit of simple understanding of things. You know, electricity and efficiency, because you're not going to get this kind of talk at your average college where they're teaching you the standards, the conventional method of doing anything. It's the unconventional method, the outside-the-box way of thinking, and looking at that in a different way. Like, for example, we want electricity, obviously, because we want lights, we want heat, we want refrigeration. But why can't we take that same amount of energy that we're already purchasing anyway, instead of having to purchase twice or three times or maybe even 10 times the amount, because we're using it in such an inefficient manner? Why don't we take the knowledge and the physics and the science provided for us and build systems that will work as smart systems between our appliances and the power grid, so that we're only using what it is we actually need? And so what I hope to accomplish for the people out there is I want to build a custom circuit that I can test and prove and open source to the public out there, to show you that, look, when I'm going to run my computer, I'm not going to run it directly from the wall socket, because my computer is inefficient. So what I'm going to do is build this circuit that's a smart circuit that will only give my computer what my computer requires, nothing more, nothing less, and it will regulate the temperature, it will regulate the amount of power going to it, it will protect my computer from surges, it will protect my computer from failure, because if the power does go out, I'll have an alarm tell me, yo, you got like 15 minutes to shut it down, just like a battery backup does. But more efficient than a battery backup, because even a battery backup has inefficiencies when it's plugged into the power supply, because it has a primary coil. Anything that has a primary coil could benefit by this technology, because anything that has a primary coil, even when not in use, is still accepting power from the grid. That constant fluctuation at 50 or 60 hertz, and that power constantly coming in, putting more power to it than it actually needs because it ain't being used right now, causes it to get hot. So even if you go around your house and you feel your little transformers, even when nothing's plugged into it, they're hot because there's constantly energy flowing through there. But if the circuit senses that you're not actually using that transformer, it will shut that transformer off until you turn it on and it demands a load. The moment it demands a load, then it'll turn your transformer back on in a smooth fashion so that it's not harming your appliance. So now you'll have a smart house instead of just an average surge protector that hopefully will catch any high voltage surge coming to your appliance and shut the thing off before it destroys anything. This will be one that will not only shut it off when it's not being used, but it will also turn it back on in a smooth fashion so that you don't have this sudden boost of power coming into your appliances and causing damage. So what I hope to accomplish by this is to build a circuit that at the very least your average Joe can use these to save themselves money as far as utility bills and stuff like that. These same concepts not only apply with electricity, they apply with heating and cooling. Little tricks of the trade about understanding heat rises and cold air falls means you could modify your existing furnace system to, instead of pushing the air conditioning and the heating through either the floor or the ceiling, you know the heat rises, so you want your heat to go to the floor, you want your AC to go to the ceiling. So in your modern day systems, it may mean you have to run some new ductwork through your attic, but it now means that with a little switch, where just like in your automobile, it will change the airflow from the floor to the ceiling, and so now your cool air will be pumped up through the ceiling, and your AC will be just as efficient as your heating in the winter and in the summertime. They'll both be pushing out the same amount of energy, so you won't have to work your air conditioner harder because you've got your AC ducts running through the floor, or you won't, in the wintertime, you won't have to work your heater harder because you got your heat going through the ceiling. Heat rises and cold falls. So for super efficiency, a little minor modification to your system for your home heating will make all the difference and make your heating and cooling so much efficient that you'll see an actual decrease in your electric bill every month. And so those types of systems, whether they be heat and water, heating, cooling, electrical, or whatever, we can guide that energy to where we want it to go, therefore becoming so incredibly efficient that we don't have to waste so much money every month trying to sustain our comfort. So you don't have to lose out on any luxuries, and these same things could actually benefit other individuals in other countries by making these things so incredibly efficient that they can afford to run them as well, and other devices such as for water purification. Here at Mad Science, you're going to hear about all of it. We're going to bring brilliant minds to the table, knowledge in every single realm of whether it be for alternative medicine, alternative electricity, energy uses, or whatever, and we're going to show you the best of the best of technology that's readily available out there. If you haven't found it by yourself, then we'll help you find it. And if you found it and we haven't found it, throw it on the table, because those are the pieces of puzzle necessary to ease the burden of our fellow brothers and sisters all over the planet. And I know if we decide to do this, we can make it happen. We need dream teams in every neighborhood, every community, every town, city, state, country. Just, if you like what you've heard here today, folks, please share this podcast with somebody. I haven't checked to see if Weebly's still got that deal, but I do have a backup podcast place to upload podcasts. It may be a case of I've put so many podcasts up there, I'm out of storage space, so I didn't find that out yet. But either way, the podcast will be up after the show, and if you like what you've heard here and you want to share that information with somebody, please do that, because that's how you help support us here at ShazizRadio.com. So, Raymond, you got any last words of wisdom before we peel up out of here?
No, but I got a lot of questions before we get off the air.
Alright, well, that's about that. And folks, join us. God willing, we'll be here for the Knights of the Round Table in the morning. Duct tape and bailing wires, what we're working with. And so, dusty old computers and keyboards and antique out-of-date monitors and computers, but we're still going, so we're going to use whatever it takes to get this information out to you because we love you so.
That stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one hand.
Ooh, one hand. Yeah, you're right. It's just one hand.
Yeah, boss. They're puny.
Hmm, puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.